History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. If you had to make a Mount Rushmore of the most important people in the civil rights movement, a few names would easily come to your mind: Martin Luther King Jr., W.E.B. Du Bois, Booker T. Washington. But there's another person who arguably belongs there who's been largely forgotten, and that's Walter Francis White. He was a black man who led two lives. On the one hand, as a leader of the NAACP in the Harlem Renaissance, an architected victory at the Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court decision, and on the other hand, he lived as a white journalist who investigated lynching crimes in the Deep South. Although White was the most powerful political black figure in America during the 1930s and 1940s, his full story hasn't been told until now, largely due to a scandal that happened at the end of his life. Today's guest is A.J. Bamey. He's the author of the new book, White Lies, The Double Life of Walter F. White and America's Darkest Secret. White was born mixed race with very fair skin and straight hair, which allowed him to pass as a white man and investigate 41 lynchings and eight race riots between 1918 and 1931. As a second generation of the Ku Klux Klan incited violence across the country, White risked his life to report on the Red Summer of 1919, the Tulsa Massacre of 1921, the Marion lynchings of 1930, and more. His reports drew national attention and fueled the beginnings of the civil rights movement. White then rose in the NAACP office as chief executive. As leader of the NAACP, he had full access to the Oval Offices of FDR and Harry Truman, and was arguably the most powerful force in the historic realignment of black political power from the Republican to the Democratic Party. Interestingly enough, he also grew the NAACP in terms of membership by orders of magnitude, which allowed that group to represent the black community instead of the American Communist Party, which tried to do the same in the 1930s. White also helped found the Harlem Renaissance as a famed novelist and Harlem celebrity, and he hosted apartment parties where black and white audiences alike were introduced to Paul Robeson singing, Langston Hughes' verse, and George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. But a good reason why White's story hasn't been remembered all that well is due to his controversial decision to divorce his black wife and marry a white woman, which shattered his reputation as a black civil rights leader and caused his own children to disown him. But when looking at the full weight of his life in context, he really was a remarkable figure, and his story not only fills in a lot of gaps of the story of the 20th century civil rights movement, but also explores the incredible complexity and also contradictions of race in the United States. A lot to unpack here, so I hope you enjoy this conversation with A.J. Bamey. A.J., great to have you back on the show.
Scott, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right, well, last time we talked about Missouri's favorite son, Harry Truman. No one was as lucky or who failed upward in life, but actually did very well with the hand that he was dealt, like him. So now we're going to talk about someone else equally interesting, but in a different way. So before getting into the life of Walter Francis White, I want to talk about one of the larger stories behind his life, one of the meta themes, and that's racial identity and racial passing. So we'll find out that he was active in America's black community, but it seems like for all intents and purposes, if you saw him and didn't know anything about him, you would assume he's white. Is that accurate if we're talking about him?
Absolutely, of course. And in fact, you know, on the cover of White Lies, you don't see his picture, but when you flip to the first page, you see a picture of him, what we call a frontispiece of a book, because I wanted to make sure readers could understand what he looked like, because identity and complexion and skin color is obviously, you know, at the heart of the book and of the story of his life.
Right. Wikipedia told me that 27 of his 32 great-great-grandparents were white. So that's something like 15% black. And that's less than Meghan Markle, if we want to have some kind of visual idea. So one thing I'm curious about is a person like this who can operate in the white community, he does in his career, which we'll talk about. He is also doing things, of course, very active in the black community. He hosts parties, introducing black and white culture to each other. Do you think people like this who help uplift marginal communities are often people who can move in between different communities with greater ease? And it doesn't have to be racial. It could be marginalized ethnic groups or racial groups. Do you think it's these types of people who can move in between camps who typically really help uplift these communities, or does it not matter as much?
I don't think it matters as much, and I can't think of any example in all my reading and history and all my research of any figure like Walter Francis White who could so easily and you know, as in 100% move from one world to the other, sometimes with the other knowing who he was and his racial identity, and sometimes his racial identity might have been a secret. So I really think his story specifically stands out. And the story of his life is really sort of weaponizing, if you will, his ability to do so. So he becomes a crime fighter and an undercover investigator, a black man posing as a white man and, you know, investigating racist murders and things like that. I don't think there's really any example like him anywhere in history that I've ever read.
Well, let's talk about his background, because he very well could be descended by a president based on some family lore. He's part of the elite in his city. So very interesting. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, well, listen, he was born, both of his parents came from enslaved families. So they are his, both of his mother and his father were the last generation of Americans who could speak from the slave era from memory from enslaved families. But he himself was born with white skin, blonde hair, and blue eyes. Now, how does this happen? He sort of is this sort of walking symbol of this historical narrative of our country in which slave women had no rights to their body, and their owners had full rights with full impunity to do what they wished. And through that, generation after generation, skin color changed. So Walter was, his great-grandmother birthed six children by her owner, who went on to become a president of the United States. I believe it was William Henry Harrison. So that sort of gives you an idea of how this person could be born in the 1890s and 1893 in Atlanta, go to a black school, go to a black church, member of a black family, but have white skin, blue eyes, and blonde hair.
Yeah, it really speaks to the idea of the one drop rule, that people who you hear of, figures that are described as black, such as Sally Hemings, who was part of Thomas Jefferson's household. There's argument over whether or not she fathered his children or she mothered his children. And she's something like, I think, 5'6" European, something like that. So is that focus on one drop rule or miscegenation laws what you think pushes them to so strongly adopt a black identity?
Well, it's an interesting question, and Walter addresses it in his lifetime. In fact, there's one scene in the book where he's in a church with another writer, with a writer named Conrad Berkovici. And Conrad points to a kid who's handing out church literature and says, well, surely that guy's white. And he's surprised because this is in the 1920s in Harlem. And Walter says, no, he's not. He has used the term colored, which is the term they would have used at the time. And the idea being, if you have one drop of black blood, then you are black. And if you keep that a secret, then, and if it's ever exposed, then you're going to be, you know, ostracized and this and that. So that was his definition of it. And through his life, he became such a curiosity among Americans that all sorts of people sort of placed percentiles on him of how white and how black he was. But it didn't matter, because if, in from his own perspective, if he had black blood, then he was a black man.
Right. I think Warren G. Harding was claimed by one of his opponents, Hatchet Men, that he had black ancestry, which interestingly enough has caused him to be perceived as one of the early black presidents of the United States. So that's an interesting afterlife of that myth. But how is white perceived by people around him within Atlanta's black community, within opponents throughout his life? What did they make of him?
Very much a curiosity. Now, that's part of the narrative that changes through White Lies. At the beginning, he's accepted in his community in Atlanta as a black man, and everybody knows his family. They go to, you know, this prestigious black neighborhood church. He goes to Atlanta University, black university. It's not really until, well, one thing I should say is that he realizes early in his life that he can choose. He has this amazing opportunity to choose to go out and live in America as a white man and construct his whole identity around that and all the advantages that could create for him. You know, I have to remember times were not good in 1906. But what happens is he witnesses as a child the 1906 Atlanta riot, and he sees 12 people murdered, 12 black people murdered by whites. And he's 13 years old at the time. And that becomes the sort of foundation of his mythology. And that's when he becomes like a black civil rights crusader and goes on to become the famous black civil rights crusader of his era, the first half of the 20th century. But growing up, he was a black man and never thought of himself any other way. It wasn't until 1918 when he joined the NAACP, he reads about this racist, this murder of a black man named James McElhenry down in Tennessee. And he's like, wait a minute, I could go down to Tennessee, pretend to be a white newspaper reporter, crack this case, find out who killed this man, and publish it all over the newspapers, which is exactly what he does. And that's the springboard for his sort of career.
Yeah, I really want to dive into that, but I'm curious what he does, where he's we'll say passing as white, but it's, I mean, the categories are so murky here. What does that mean at this time in his life? Because this is something that has happened throughout America's history and even before America's history as a nation, of people of one ethnic group or racial group trying to be categorized in a different way for legal reasons, which in the antebellum era can mean the difference between freedom and slavery. This is in the Jim Crow era. So what does racial passing mean at this time in America's history, and what are the possible dangers?
Well, it was prevalent. And even Walter says, you know, he knew many, many people, even people in public life, who lived as white people, who he believed to be colored would be the term that he would use. Now, he himself, again, when he saw the 1906 Atlanta race riot, that's when he makes a decision. And he says this, it's right at the end of chapter one. He's like, I knew which side I was on. I knew that these people were coming to hunt for me because I was a black man, even though my skin was the same color as these people in the Atlanta race riot who were coming to burn down my house. They looked exactly like me. They had blue eyes and blonde hair like me. But he made a choice at that age, at 13, to live his life throughout as a black man. And he only passed as white when it served his purposes to achieve the goals that he wanted. And those changed through time. And throughout the book, he becomes villainized, even sometimes by the black community, for being too white. He becomes almost like a tug of war, you know, the rope in a tug of war between the two races.
Right. And I mean, in this conversation, it sounds kind of strange to try to nail down, oh, is he black? Is he white? When we're talking about, in one sense, a fictionalized category. But at this time in history, when there are laws constructed about this, it does mean something at this time. So, I mean, there really is, I mean, something to it. So tell me about his journalism career. With his investigative journalism, you mentioned that he cracks this case. So please tell me more about that and how he does this, how he gathers evidence, how he potentially exposes himself to danger and everything else there.
Excellent. Let me just address one thing you just said, Scott. One thing I think is really in a very clear way for listeners to understand what Walter's life was like would be to get on a streetcar in Atlanta when he was a child, because there were laws. Black people had to sit from the back, all the way in the back, up to the front. White people had to sit in the front, all the way in the back, all the way toward the back. And there were strict rules and laws. But every time he and his family got on a streetcar, they had to make a choice, because if they sat in the back and people didn't know them, they would be ostracized, villainized, even potentially targets of violence. And so every time he came out into public life and walked down a street, he had the opportunity to pick and choose who he wanted to be according to every single situation in his life, which, again, is something we explore in the book. As he goes through time and he gains power, he weaponizes that ability. Now, speaking of weaponizing that ability, in 1918, he goes and poses as a white newspaper reporter in the South to find out what happened in this murder of a guy named James McElhern. And he's able, in one day, he poses actually this first time as a hair product salesman with a company called Excellento Medicine Company. And he goes to this tiny town in Tennessee where this murder has happened and no one has been charged. And he knows that there were hundreds and hundreds of people who witnessed this murder in this tiny little town. And he shows up posing as a white man, finds out who did it because everybody's willing to talk about it because he's not black or does not appear to be. He goes back to New York, writes a report that's published in the NAACP's magazine called The Crisis, and it causes a firestorm. And that's the first time he does this. I was able to track down all his notebooks, his papers, even photographs, and sort of reconstruct, if you will, in as vivid detail as I could, many of the 44 undercover investigations that he conducted through the early years of his life up to 1931. And they're shocking, and they shocked Americans at the time. But what was amazing about it is he would uncover these crimes where there'd be more people than there were at some major league baseball games, witnessing the torture and burning at the stake of a human being right here in the United States of America with nobody charged for any crimes. And that's what his goal was. He became a crime fighter, and his skin color enabled him to do that more effectively than anyone else.
Did that become more dangerous over time when perhaps word got around that there's this person with black ancestry who looks white, who's trying to pass and is actually trying to implicate us and gather information because he knows he can move among us? And does this come back to him after a while?
That's exactly right, Scott. And if you, the more famous he gets through the book, the older he gets, he becomes very famous in Harlem quickly, very famous in New York. But in the 1920s, he could leave New York and not be known. But the more famous he got, every time he went on an investigation undercover, usually posing as a white newspaper reporter, these investigations became more and more dangerous because he knew if his identity was found out, he wouldn't just be murdered. He would be ruthlessly tortured, just like the victims in the murders that he was investigating. And in fact, you know, we're talking about burnings at the stakes, being unsexed, if you will, which was a term that they used at the time. You can imagine what that might be. And there's one point where he's in Phillips, Arkansas, investigating this racial riot in which dozens of Black people were killed, and his identity is learned, and he finds out, and he literally has to sprint to a train station and get on this train, and he has to buy a ticket, and the counter says, "Where are you going, son? They're about to have this big party. There's a guy down here posing as a white man who's Black, and the guys are going to have some fun with him." So even the guy at the ticket booth who sells him the ticket to get out of town because he's about to be murdered has no idea that he is, in fact, the Black person he's talking about.
Wow. Yeah, that's a really interesting point there. How does he get out of that situation?
Sprints to the train. There were only two trains that left town because these investigations happen in very, very small towns. And that's important because in these were insular communities where you could have a murder in front of thousands of people in which nobody would say anything. But he escaped by the sort of skin of his teeth, if you will. And that was the most sort of dangerous episode. But every time he went and did one of these investigations, he had to know that there was a chance he wouldn't come back alive.
It's really interesting. I mean, it makes it sound like that the national conscience didn't know about these types of lynchings. I mean, or did they know? Were they not well publicized? Were these things that were common knowledge in smaller Southern communities, but kept under wrap and spoke about quietly and alluded to, but not known nationally? Or were they, but there had never been as counts as vivid as what he portrayed? What new information did he bring to the national consciousness?
Well, I think exactly, you're right on the money what you said. So it was sort of this is why I call it the darkest secret on the cover of the book. That's in the subtitle. Because it was something that Americans knew about. We in America, we knew that these lynchings happened, and they happened with some regularity in a certain part of the country because they would show up. When it happened, it would show up in the New York Times. And that's how Walter would learn a lot about these cases in numerous instances. But nobody was ever arrested. Nobody was ever held accountable. Even though people vaguely knew about it, it would be like something you would see on the sports page and be like, "Oh, the Giants won again." You know, that doesn't happen often, but it happens. Oh, somebody was burned at the stake in Tennessee. It's remarkable. It's amazing to think that that's what was happening in our country at the time, but it was. And what Walter's goal was to collect all the facts, publish these scathing reports in newspapers like the New York World, which was the most widely read paper, the Joseph Pulitzer paper in New York. In The Crisis, which was distributed nationally, in the Chicago Defender, which was distributed nationally. And he wanted to put a spotlight on these cases and hope that somebody would be held accountable. And time and again, as he got more famous, his reports got more famous. And he was really this person who brought this secret out from behind this curtain into the American consciousness. When he became head of the NAACP in 1931, he sort of changed his strategy. And we can get into that after, because he realized These same kinds of cases are happening, Scott, obviously, here in our country now. We still have conflict between Black and white in which we're trying to figure out how we hold people accountable in this country. What do the laws mean? What do we do if they're not enforced? Walter's goal during his investigations is really put a spotlight on that and make it a national phenomenon, which is exactly what he did.
Yeah, I mean, the work with the Legal Defense Fund brings up some of the most important Supreme Court cases in the 20th century. But something else that's interesting with his life is that in this period in American history, when the Black community, its wealthiest, most influential, most educated members are mobilizing and putting together the infrastructure for the civil rights movement, there's a lot of interesting internal debates that are happening. And he's clearly in one camp, and also in a camp that ends up winning out. One thing that is that a question of whether or not the Black community should try to integrate in American society or have voluntary separation, which the latter W.B. Du Bois supported. So can you tell me about that conflict and why White was on the side that he was on?
Yes. White joined the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, in 1918. And the goal of this organization was to erase the color line in all its forms. That, you know, would like the I Have a Dream speech from Martin Luther King many, many years later. That was the strategy. That was the goal. The goal would be, it didn't matter what the color of your skin was. It had nothing to do with who you were, did not dictate your place in society. That was the goal of the NAACP. That's what Walter White was fighting for. And he was using his criminal investigations as a tool to do so. Later on in life, W.E.B. Du Bois was a very important figure, intellectual, probably easily the most prominent Black intellectual in American culture. And he had this moment, it was 1934, 1935, where he began to publish these editorials saying that, you know what, I give up. He was saying, essentially, we haven't made any progress here. We should have segregation in America. We should have separate racial identities and destinies. And this is something that during the 1920s, we saw to some degree in a very different way, Marcus Garvey fighting for. He was not a fan of integration. And Walter was, and that's what he fought for his whole life. And when W.E.B. Du Bois came out with this idea of segregation in the mid-1930s, Walter flipped on him, and it created this amazing conflict that was ripping the NAACP apart right when it was really becoming a big national powerhouse, a political powerhouse, a voting rights powerhouse, a powerhouse within the realms of the Supreme Court. So this rivalry was intensely important, and Walter won out. And so that continued to be, and I believe continues to be, I can't speak for the NAACP because I'm not among its leadership today, but I believe that still is its goal, as you know, as Walter saw it then.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Right. I mean, and for that camp that would go in that direction that we need to separate within U.S. society, for the struggles that they face in the 20th century, I can understand that they think, well, this isn't the ideal alternative, but the best that we can do. But White disagreed. So what allowed White to prevail in that argument that was happening within the early civil rights movement?
Well, let me answer that question this way. The first half of the book, the first half of his career was really dedicated to these undercover investigations. Now, in 1931, he becomes the executive secretary of the NAACP. So when he joins in 1918, it's this tiny, unheard of organization that by the time 1931 comes along, it's the most powerful and militant Black organization. But really, it was biracial. And I think it's very important to know that, to understand that, that the NAACP was not a Black organization. It was a Black and white organization. It was founded to be so, to erase the color line in all its forms. In the second half of the book, Walter realizes, now I'm in charge of this biggest, most powerful civil rights organization that has ever existed. And we've really failed. All of these undercover investigations, we've used art as a tool to fight for civil rights. We've used publicity, and it hasn't worked that well. So what he decides to do is turn the NAACP into a political juggernaut, and then to hire the best young Black lawyer alive to create this defense organization that's going to fight for education rights and fight for voting rights. You know, think about it. A lot of people probably don't know that in 1908, Georgia, you know, had state constitutional laws put on the books that outlawed Blacks from voting. African Americans could not vote for most of the first half of the 20th century in numerous states in the South. People don't even know that today. That shocks me. And so one of the things he did as head of the NAACP was to fight for voting rights, fight for education rights. And at the end of his life, that really climaxed in Brown versus Board of Education.
In the early stages of the NAACP's legal defense fund, another interesting thing from his life is that there's a struggle among who will represent the Black community. The NAACP wants to, but another group that wants to is the American Communist Party. So really glad it did not go in that direction, because I mean, the implications would be horrifying there. But can you tell me about that struggle and then why ultimately the Communist Party didn't become sort of the voice of the Black community in the United States?
Sure. So this, what you're talking about really focuses on a story called the Scottsboro Boys. And that should, if you're interested in history, you've heard of that before. And the case was about 13 young Black hobos, essentially, who were arrested for hoboing, but then were accused of raping two white women, a rape that we don't really believe ever actually happened. And these men were, young men, were arrested and charged with all sorts of crimes and life sentences in this. And the NAACP, part of its role and part of Walter's role, was to show up in court cases like this and help defend these people who he believed were innocent. And what happened was, the Scottsboro case, this drew a huge amount of publicity, and hundreds and hundreds and thousands of people went to Arkansas, I mean, to Alabama, Scottsboro, with, you know, guns and Bibles and fighting for one side or the other. It was a huge case. And the NAACP had this dream team of lawyers, Clarence Darrow and Arthur Garfield Hayes, who they'd used in the past to defend in cases like this, notably the Sweet case in 1925-1926, which is a huge chapter and a fascinating part of our history, our racial history. That was in Detroit. So the NAACP wants to bring this dream team of lawyers to defend the Scottsboro Boys. But this is the mid-1930s. And this is something, again, that I think people don't really realize how powerful the communist, the American Communist Party was in the 30s when so many people were poor. There was a lot of people who advocated taking whatever resources and wealth we had and spread it out. And the American Communist Party was recruiting heavily among African Americans, and they sent in their lawyers to defend the Scottsboro Boys. And the Communist Party swept the case away from the NAACP. It was a disaster for the Scottsboro Boys, and it was a disaster for Walter White. But ultimately, the power of the Communist Party disappeared as World War II came, and that struggle within Black America, if you will, dissipated.
Right. This is the era not too long after Huey Long, the governor of Louisiana, who is advocating very socialist ideas. This is before the Cold War, where communism isn't considered anathema. So if the Black community had closely linked itself up with that, I just can't imagine all the problems that would have resulted. Well, tell me about the Legal Defense Fund with the NAACP and the string of victories that ultimately culminate in Brown versus Board of Education.
Sure. In the second half of Walter's life, he's aligning himself with the most powerful people in the country. He starts out as this, undercover investigator guy who nobody's ever heard of. But by the 1930s, he's a frequent guest in FDR's Oval Office. He becomes very close with Eleanor Roosevelt, and he's recruiting the three most powerful people who he recruits to be on his side and help in his fight are Clarence Darrow, Eleanor Roosevelt, and a young brash lawyer named Thurgood Marshall. Now, that's a name that should definitely ring bells for your listeners. He goes on, Thurgood Marshall, of course, becomes the first Black American Supreme Court justice. But when he joins the NAACP, I believe it's 1934, he's this young lawyer who has this idea to take on small education cases to fight segregation in schools. And he becomes quickly successful. And Walter helps to give him this platform, introduces him to all these powerful people like Eleanor Roosevelt and Wendell Willkie, and helps Thurgood really string together these education cases, and each one builds on the next. And that's what eventually, it takes well over a decade before Brown versus Board of Education, which is one of the climactic moments at the end of the book, where they finally win this huge case that's years in the making. But it's very much, I think, the reason why it occurred was because of the brilliance of Thurgood Marshall and the team of Walter White and Marshall within the NAACP to get the resources to make this happen.
He wasn't just involved in politics or legal efforts, but also literary efforts too, and played a huge role in the Harlem Renaissance and hosted parties where Black and white groups come together, and there's probably lots of cultural cross-pollination happening there. So what effect did this have?
Well, a huge effect. The point of this book, I think, is to explore Walter's life as he goes and creates this existence in white America and Black America. So in the 1920s, at the same time, he's consistently going into the South and Alabama and Georgia, Arkansas, posing as a white man to investigate these racial murders. He's also living openly as a Black man in Harlem right at the beginning of the Harlem Renaissance. And he becomes sort of the de facto publicist. He wants to empower every single young talent to make this Renaissance happen because he believes that one of the most effective ways that we can fight for civil rights in America is through artistic expression and through great literature, through the creation of great literature, great art. So he wants to empower all of these young talents around him and, in fact, becomes an internationally well-known novelist himself. So it's, when I was writing it, like I was sort of living in these worlds. One day I would be in the South in rural Tennessee, using all of my resources to experience what he was experiencing through all of my senses. And the next day I was doing the same thing and I was in Harlem experiencing the Harlem Renaissance. And his actual apartment was a gathering place where he would throw these amazing soirees where like George Gershwin debuted Rhapsody in Blue on Walter White's piano, County Cullen, Langston Hughes, Arnold Bontemps, and all of these famous people we know of now would gather there as young, unknown people and for these parties. And they came together and created this Renaissance, which is now something that we still celebrate to this day.
Well, events at the end of his life caused his legacy to not be remembered perhaps as well as it should be, which we can get to in a second. But overall, what do you characterize as the influence he had? What do you think were some of the biggest accomplishments that he helped cause to happen in America?
I think that anybody who reads this book will walk away and say, without a doubt, without any doubt at all, that Walter White, Walter Francis White, was the most powerful civil rights activist in the first half of the 20th century. It shocks me that people don't know who he is today, but there's a reason why. There was a scandal at the end of the book, and you know, we'll talk about that. But that's his accomplishment. He was the most effective and powerful civil rights leader of the first half of the 20th century, without a doubt. His story begins with these undercover racial murder investigations. He becomes a political figure, and really he ends up forming this very close relationship with Harry Truman and convinces Harry Truman in 1947 to go full bore on the civil rights thing, which Harry Truman did. And this is something, this is one of the reasons why I've been working and researching Walter White for years, because I've written two books on Truman and Walter appears in them. So it's a climactic moment when the president of the United States, at the foot of the Lincoln Memorial, addresses the NAACP's biggest meeting in all its history in 1947, and comes out and says, like, we have to get rid of the color line in America. We have to read the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence and actually believe in them, actually live as they tell us to live as Americans. And so that's Walter White's biggest, I think, accomplishment. Now, you touched on why we don't know about him as much anymore. Do you want me to talk about that?
Sure. Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
Well, two reasons. One is, as we're exploring Walter's life, going back and forth between white America and black America, one of the things that happens is he has a black wife and black children, but he's secretly in love with a white woman, and he begins to have an affair with her. And it's this incredibly dangerous dalliance that he's having because he's head of the NAACP by this point. He's the most powerful black civil rights leader in America. And he knows that if he gets caught having this affair with a white woman, that will destroy him. For reasons that I get into the book that are a little tricky, I can explain. But essentially, the biggest thing that white politicians at the time excused lynchings on the floor of Congress because they had this narrative that black men were lynched because they were trying to get at white women. And they would, black, white politicians, congressmen, senators, they said this on the floor of the Congress. It's in the congressional record over and over and over. And Walter was out there saying, actually, that's not true. You know, black men are not trying to rape white women. They should not be lynched. And he knew that if he got caught having a secret affair with a white woman, that as a black man, he would be accused of trying to, you understand what I'm saying, that all along he was just full of bleep, that he was a black man trying to have an affair with a white woman. And all of these politicians would say, see, we told you so.
And play into the worst stereotypes that people have.
Right.
Yeah.
So ultimately, late in life, he divorces his black wife and marries this white woman, and the scandal destroys him and plays out at the end of the book. And it's sad to see the degree of the vitriol that is laid upon him. And that's what's going on when he dies. And when he dies in 1955, right after, Martin Luther King comes on the scene and Rosa Parks appears as these figures of the new face of black civil rights. And they jettison Walter very quickly because the whole idea of having a man with white skin and blonde hair and blue eyes be the most powerful figure in black America did not sit well with them. And so he disappeared from our national conversation completely.
And I think his children disown him, is that correct? And others around him?
They did. His own son changed his last name because when Walter left his mother for a white woman, his children disowned him. His son changed his name. He lost all his power as head of the NAACP and kind of became a figurehead. And Walter Wilkins took over, and Walter ran the NAACP for decades after that. But yeah, it destroyed Walter. It destroyed him to some degree emotionally, but I think he knew the consequences before he decided that he was going to go and do what he did.
Had he not been remarried, stayed with his wife, whatever, and continued on the trajectory he was on for the most of his career, how do you think he would be remembered?
I think he would be remembered as one of the great civil rights leaders of all time. I really do. I think that scandal absolutely destroyed him. And I think if he hadn't left his black wife for a white woman late in his life, we would all know who he was today. Who he was today, we wouldn't think of Walter White as a character in an HBO drama. We would know who Walter Francis White is. He would be in our history books. He would, his story would be taught in schools.
Well, I'm curious, when you look at his life and all the incredible success that he had, and of course, it wasn't just him. He was part of a gigantic movement with the labors of tens of thousands, if not millions, behind them. But considering the change that he saw over his life from lynchings being tolerated or quietly tolerated throughout the nation to the point where legal discrimination in schools is gone. I mean, there's, of course, decades more work to be done, and you could rightly say it's still not finished. But what do you characterize as what made him so effective at what he did in all these different arenas?
Well, he was able to use his skin color to be highly, highly manipulative. He was sort of playing everybody to get what it was that he wanted. But he also had terrific, terrific charisma. He had absolute courage, totally fearless, fearless at the pulpit, fearless in his speaking, fearless in his undercover investigations, fearless when he walked into the Oval Office. He was a force of change. And I think that people are going to read this book and be like, wow, this dude accomplished a lot. Like, it's amazing that I've never heard of this story. That's what I'm hoping.
And then lastly, some of the common themes you see in this book, there are practices that still exist in the 21st century, but were radically different. So when I first heard about his life and a bit of the synopsis and him passing and moving to racial camps, the first thing that came to my mind was the case of Rachel Dolezal, who, if listeners don't know, this is a very interesting case where she was the former head of the NAACP in Spokane, Washington, claimed that she was part American Indian, part Black, and she had grown up hunting food with her family with bows and arrows. Turns out she's a white girl from North Dakota, and she just put this spray tan stuff on her to claim to be biracial. And there was another case last year where Jessica Krug, who was a African history professor, was also falsely passing as African American. So I'm not saying we're in such a utopia now that people are moving in the other direction, but I don't know. What does it say that this practice is happening in different directions now compared to a century ago?
Well, it's a very, very difficult question to answer. And I'm definitely not an expert on Rachel Dolezal.
Yeah.
But you know, one thing I can say is this, like in the epilogue of the book, I have Walter looking at what would he think of our world today? And I don't think anything would surprise him. Not even to see, you know, people break into the Capitol building and parade a Confederate flag. Nothing would surprise him, except for maybe the fact that there was a senator, a Black senator from Georgia elected to the United States Senate. That I think would have pleased him terrifically. But, you know, race is an issue in our country that doesn't really exist the way it does in our country, anywhere else really in the world, the way it does here. And it's so ingrained in our history and our identities. It's something that's, you know, always going to be a story told in ways that we didn't quite expect. And I think that's, if you read White Lies, I think that's what you're going to experience most of all. But we're going to continue to see stories in the future where this you know, whole idea crops up in ways that we never thought it would.
Well, seeing people like this, that their influence is typically discounted and they have the type of background we wouldn't expect that time and place, or the exact type of things that I like to add more nuance to time periods in America's past that we think we know that we don't know as well. So for listeners who want to check out your book, the name is White Lies, The Double Life of Walter F. White and America's Darkest Secret. AJ, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Scott. Always a pleasure. Thank you.
All right. That is all for today's episode. If you'd like to see show notes for this and all my other episodes and include sources, maps, or other relevant information, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. Parthenon is the name of the podcast network that History Unplugged is a part of, along with other great history shows like James Early's Key Battles of American History, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, and other shows as well. If you'd like to support History Unplugged, there are two easy ways to do so. The first is to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. This really helps the show grow. The second thing is to join our membership program on Patreon. And if you do so, you can get completely ad-free episodes of the entire back catalog of the show, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening and see you next time.